Welcome to New World Notes number 155. I am Kenneth Doust. Gangsters and pirates. Who are the real ones? And who are the ones most likely to get busted? You can probably think of a good answer to both questions, but I hope you'll stay tuned anyway. In today's show, you probably won't encounter any major new ideas that you didn't already know. I know what you're thinking. Well, Ken, isn't that true of all your shows? Okay, fair enough. In any case, this week we offer a generous helping of true wit. If you were an English major, you'll recall that Alexander Pope defined this thus. True wit is nature to advantage dressed, what oft was thought but ne'er so well expressed. Of course, when I say oft was thought, I mean by the people who are likely to be listening to New World Notes, not the people who care deeply about who will be this year's American Idol. This week's show was conceived in late January when Michael Peretti published a really nice essay in Common Dreams online on a frustrating aspect of his Italian-American heritage. Mention Italian-American, and everybody thinks mafia. What percentage of Italian-Americans are mafia? Then Parenti asks another eminently sensible question. Granted that there is a mafia, how many people has La Cosa Nostra killed, and how many has Donald Rumsfeld? Who was more likely to steal all your wealth, Angelo Bruno or the investment firm in charge of your pension fund? So this show will offer variations on the same theme. We'll hear Parenti's essay on being Italian. And John Perkins, who worked for an international development organization and eventually realized that the best title for his job was economic hitman. And there's the mafia again. And the real mafia was back in the news again, just days after Parenti's essay was published. In a most impressive publicity stunt, 800 law enforcement officers once again broke up the mafia in New York, New Jersey, and Rhode Island. Here's the AP story, published January 21. New York. For nearly 30 years, federal authorities say, reputed gangster Bartolomeo Vernacci got away with murder. But Vernacci's luck ran out Thursday when he was charged in a double slaying in one of the largest mafia takedowns in FBI history. He was among 127 defendants named in 16 indictments stemming from separate underworld investigations in New York, New Jersey, and Rhode Island. Past investigations have resulted in strategic strikes aimed at crippling individual crime families. This time, authorities used a shotgun approach, with some 800 federal agents and police officers making scores of simultaneous arrests. Got it? Biggest mafia bust in recent memory, requiring 800 cops in 3 states, and the biggest catch of the day, Bartolomeo Vernacci, is to be charged with 2, count 'em, 2 murders. Well, 2 murders is too many, but let's have a sense of perspective here. How many innocent men, women, and children died yesterday in Pakistan and Afghanistan because the U.S. military believed that a bad man was inside the same building they were? So they fired a hellfire missile that brought down the entire building, crushing to death everybody who wasn't burned to death. Apparently that's not murder, that's protecting America from terrorism. And next time General David Petraeus returns to U.S. soil, don't expect 800 cops to be waiting for him at the airport, unless they're planning a big motorcade for this great hero. To his credit, Michael Parenti can make such points with a lighter touch than I. I've condensed it a bit for radio. Let's have a listen. Banksters, racketeers, and the mafiosi we should be worried about. The Mafia and Me, Reflections on Being Italian, by Michael Parenti. Like many other Italian-Americans, I felt some discomfort in 1951 when Senator Estes Kefauver launched his highly publicized investigation into the organized rackets, uncovering scores of thugs with Italian surnames. Subsequent decades produced an endless parade of such rogues whose mugs were splashed across the media. I must admit that when it comes to names, the mafia operatives really had them. Lucky Luciano, Scarface Al Capone, Sammy the Bull Gravano, Joey Bananas Bonanno, Crazy Joey Gallo, Jimmy the Weasel Frettiano, Sonny Red Indelicato, and Sonny Black Napolitano. One could go on with Joey Kneecap Santorielli, Johnny Bingo Bosco, Itchy Finger Zambino, Big Polly Castellano, and Lupo the Wolf Saietta. Also Johnny Blind Man Biagio, Vinnie Gorgeous Bassiano, and Fredo the Plumber Giordino. Finally, none of us will ever forget Anthony Chicken Bleeper Bastoni. Don't ask. Then there were the Dons, whose unadorned Christian names struck sufficient terror into the hearts of their clients. Such notables as Frank Costello, Vito Genovese, and Carlo Gambino. One day in the mid-1980s, my friend, the social reformer Michael Maggio, revealed to me that Angelo Bruno, the noted Philadelphia Mafia Don, was his uncle. He went on to say that Mario Puzo, author of The Godfather, had modeled his lead character, Don Corleone, after Angelo Bruno. Michael explained that his uncle Angelo had refused to deal in narcotics and sex trafficking, just as Don Corleone in the movie. For a while, Bruno kept the peace within the Philadelphia Mafia. But because he was unwilling to enter the lucrative narcotics racket, he was blasted into a premature grave by some of the hungry younger guns who wanted a piece of that action. If there was ever such a thing as a nice mafia boss, Michael Maggio ventured, it was my Uncle Angelo. Well, there is no such thing as a nice mafia boss once you look at their operations on the ground. Even if he eschewed narcotics and sex trafficking, Angelo Bruno was up to his ears in gambling, bootlegging, hijacking, loan sharking, and the protection racket. He tried to keep the peace, but when he had to come down hard in order to collect, he did. That said, Bruno's nickname was the Gentle Don. The media might give more attention to the courageous struggles for social justice waged by Italian-Americans like Michael Maggio, and a little less exposure to the Mafia Dons, be they gentle or not. The Kefauver hearings persuaded citizens that God's glorious but ever-besieged America was in the grip of an organized crime network that threatened to destroy the very fabric of our society. Or so we were repeatedly told. In fact, what the mafia bosses stole from the public was a pittance compared to the hundreds of billions of dollars that corporate America regularly plunders from workers, consumers, small investors, and taxpayers. This went largely unnoticed in all the hoopla. That Congress actually attempted to confront the mafiosi was proof enough that these hoodlums were men of limited power. They did not sit on the governing boards of corporations, banks, investment houses, foundations, universities, museums, and churches, as do the captains of industry and finance. They could not buy Capitol Hill the way the big corporations and financiers have repeatedly done. Unlike the boardroom plunderers, the mafiosi did not occupy high positions in Washington or on Wall Street. They didn't cavort with the top White House decision-makers and Pentagon contract fixers, with their million-dollar kickbacks and mysterious billion-dollar budgetary evaporations. The Mafia Dons did not play golf with the paladins of wealth, as did Dirty Dickie Cheney, or George the Bloodsucker Bush, or Slick Willie Clinton, or Barack Legs Obama, or Bernie Two-Face Madoff, or Jack Casino Abramoff, or Andy Fast Hands Fastal, or can the weasel lay? Now that's organized crime, the policymakers, not the bookmakers, the banksters, not the gangsters. The uneducated mafia thugs never got near the real money. They had to content themselves with small-time scams, numbers rackets, loan sharking, cargo thefts, extortions, even pathetic exploits like busting open parking meters for the coins. If they had a corrupting influence on public officials, it was usually pretty local and limited. Besides being small-time, these few hundred villains composed but a tiny sliver of an Italian-American population estimated at over 15 million people. But this statistic was lost in all the media hype. In the American psyche, the thugs became representative of the many millions of Italian-Americans who are accurately described as decent, hard-working, law-abiding citizens. Years ago, I was being interviewed for a teaching job at an East Coast university. The interview was being conducted by the president and the dean of the school. The three of us got into a discussion about the sociology of the family. I mentioned that for many ethnic groups, and low-income people in general, the family functioned as a unit of survival. For example, the Italians. Ah, yes, the Italians, climbed the president and the dean, suddenly keenly aware of my ethnic background. The two of them immediately launched into a discussion about Italians, referring not to the rich Italian-American historical and sociological literature, of which they were ignorant, but to the movie The Godfather. In sentimental sing-song fashion, they went on about how closely knit the gangster family was, and how important such loyalty was for the risky ventures pursued. No, I tried to say, excuse me, those are not the Italians I'm referring to. For me, the conversation was not going well, but they persisted. Having seen the movie, they could speak with expert confidence. They even took kindly care not to mention the numerous brutal murders and assaults that must have composed the more stressful side of life in the Parenti family as they imagined it. I found myself thinking that I might just slip out into the parking lot and slash their tires, if only to give some real-life confirmation to the pictures in their heads. So ends Michael Parenti's essay. So, in the middle of this nice personal essay, Parenti asks variations on this question. Who's the bigger loan shark, Vinny the Chin Gigante, or the financial companies that sold millions of adjustable-rate mortgages to people of modest means and then adjusted the rates through the ceiling? And when it comes to loan sharking plus extortion, organized crime worldwide pales in comparison with the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and related so-called development agencies. Working hand-in-hand with the big banks, the U.S. State Department, the CIA, and the U.S. military, these criminals devote themselves to plundering the assets of the world's poor countries and giving them to the world's largest transnational corporations. A repentant former agent of these sharks, John Perkins, described exactly how they operate in his celebrated 2004 book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And yes, I know I'm not being fair to sharks. We'll hear Perkins and others explain it here, part of a neat, long audio collage on the banksters. The collage was assembled by an entity known as Virtual Renderings. Here's several minutes of it. The speaker, who begins with the words, "We economic hitmen," is John Perkins.
Just as the Federal Reserve keeps the American public in a position of indentured servitude through perpetual debt, inflation, and interest, the World Bank and IMF serve this role on a global scale. The basic scam is simple. Put a country in debt, either by its own indiscretion or through corrupting the leader of that country. Then impose conditionalities or structural adjustment policies, often consisting of the following. Currency devaluation. When the value of a currency drops, so does everything valued in it, This makes indigenous resources available to predator countries at a fraction of their worth.
There must be some way out of here, say the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth.
We economic hitmen really have been the ones responsible for creating this first truly global empire. And we work many different ways. But perhaps the most common is that we will identify a country that has resources our corporations covet, like oil, and then arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations. But the money never actually goes to the country. Instead, it goes to our big corporations to build infrastructure projects in that country, power plants, industrial parks, ports, things that benefit a few rich people in that country, in addition to our corporations, but really don't help the majority of the people at all. However, those people, the whole country, is left holding a huge debt. It's such a big debt they can't repay it, and that's part of the plan. They can't repay it. And so at some point, we economic hitmen go back to them and say, listen, you lost a lot of money, can't pay your debt, so sell your oil real cheap to our oil companies. Allow us to build a military base in your country, or send troops in support of ours to someplace in the world like Iraq, or vote with us on the next UN vote to have their electric utility company privatized and their water and sewage system privatized and sold to U.S. corporations or other multinational corporations. So there was a whole mushrooming thing, and it's so typical of the way the IMF and the World Bank work. They put a country in debt, it's such a big debt it can't pay it, and then you offer to refinance that debt and pay even more interest. And you demand this quid pro quo, which you call a conditionality or good governance, which means basically that they've got to sell off their resources, including many of their social services, their utility companies, their school systems sometimes, their penal systems, their insurance systems, to foreign corporations. So it's a double, triple, quadruple whammy.
No reason to get excited, the thief he kindly spoke. There are many among us who feel that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now, the hour is getting late. Tower, princes kept the view, while all the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Outside in the distance, a wild cat did growl. Two riders were approaching, the wind began to howl.
Large funding cuts for social programs. These usually include education and healthcare, compromising the well-being and integrity of the society, leaving the public vulnerable to exploitation. Privatization of state-owned enterprises. This means that socially important systems can be purchased and regulated by foreign corporations for profit. For example, in 1999, the World Bank insisted that the Bolivian government sell the public water system of its third largest city to a subsidy of the U.S. corporation Bechtel. As soon as this occurred, water bills for the already impoverished local residents skyrocketed. It wasn't until after a full-blown revolt by the people that the Bechtel contract was nullified. Then there's trade liberalization, or the opening up of the economy through removing any restrictions on foreign trade. This allows for a number of abusive economic manifestations, such as transnational corporations bringing in their own mass-produced products, undercutting the indigenous production and ruining local economies. An example is Jamaica, which, after accepting loans and conditionalities from the World Bank, lost its largest cash crop markets due to competition with Western imports. Today, countless farmers are out of work, for they are unable to compete with the large corporations. Another variation is the creation of numerous seemingly unnoticed, unregulated, inhumane sweatshop factories, which take advantage of the imposed economic hardship. Additionally, due to production deregulation, environmental destruction is perpetual, as a country's resources are often exploited by the indifferent corporations while outputting large amounts of deliberate pollution.
The largest environmental lawsuit in the history of the world today is being brought on behalf of 30,000 Ecuadorian Amazonian people against Texaco, which is now owned by Chevron. So today it's against Chevron, but for activities conducted by Texaco. Estimated to be more than 18 times what the Exxon Valdez dumped into the coast of Alaska. In the case of Ecuador, it wasn't an accident. The oil companies did it intentionally. They knew they were doing it to save money out there rather than arranging for a proper disposal.
Furthermore, a cursory glance at the performance record of the World Bank reveals that the institution, which publicly claims to help poor countries develop and alleviate poverty, has done nothing but increase poverty and the wealth gap, while corporate profits soar.
Baring, Ambrose, Lazard, Erlanger, Warburg, Schroeder, Seligman, the Spires, Mirabeau, Mallet, Fold, and above all, Rothschild and Morgan.
Rothschild.
In 1960, the income gap between the fifth of the world's people in the richest countries versus the fifth in the poorest countries was 30-1. By 1998, it was 74-1. While global GNP rose 40% between 1970 and 1985, those in poverty actually increased by 17%. While from 1985 to 2000, those living on less than $1 a day increased by 18%. Even the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress admitted that there is a mere 40% success rate of all World Bank projects. In the late 1960s, the World Bank intervened in Ecuador with large loans. During the next 30 years, poverty grew from 50% to 70%. Under or unemployment grew from 15% to 70%. Public debt increased from $240 million to $16 billion, while the share of resources allocated to the poor went from 20% to 6%. In fact, by the year 2000, 50% of Ecuador's national budget had to be allocated for paying its debts.
Now you can't get the truth. You can't get it from no reporter. Now you can't get the truth. You can't get it from no reporter. Well, the time is getting shorter, better for the new world order. Mama, you've got to save your son and daughter. Now, 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 Mama, you've got to save your son and daughter. We're living on the border of the new.
Cool stuff. Alas, even Virtual Renderings doesn't know who did that nice bit of blues at the end. Also back in the news, along with the Mafia, are the Somali pirates. Today I was hoping to ask also, who are the real pirates of Somalia? Alas, we're out of time, and we'll have to take that up next week. So that the suspense doesn't get unbearable, I'll give you a hint. The real pirates of Somalia are not the eight guys in the rubber boat. And we'll hear more on that subject from commentator Glenn Ford and singer-songwriter David Rovix. And thus ends our variation on a familiar theme. The moral of the story is, the criminals are often bad people who do bad things. But the real damage is done by the captains of business, finance, and government, who do the same bad things, only 1,000 times worse. And they do it legally, or, if not that, at least with total immunity from prosecution. The fact that the cops periodically crack down on the Mafia shows that the Mafia has no real power. The day the cops crack down on Goldman Sachs, BP, the IMF, and most members of the Bush and Obama administrations would be a much happier day for democracy. I suppose it wouldn't do any harm to pray for this to happen, but I recommend against holding your breath. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Chaz K. and Virtual Renderings for the audio collage on The Banksters. For more by Michael Parenti, see michaelparenti.org. For all sorts of good stuff, including an archive of past installments, see our show's own website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. If you get to my non-carborundum, don't mourn, organize, and please tune in again next week. Ciao.